Katie.
I'm Erica.
And this is
Book Talk. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Erica. Welcome to Book Talk.
Book Talk's a weekly podcast where we read a section of a book, and this week we read the last section of a book, and we are here to talk about it with a very special guest joining us in a bit, Miss Luisa Luna, the author of this book. We can't wait to hear what she has to say.
We're so excited. We've got a long list of questions.
We have probably way too many questions.
Yeah, we're going to time ourselves so this is not 2 hours long for y'all, but we do have a lot of questions. We're going to selectively pick them. But first, let's get started with a quick recap of the craziness that really was these last four chapters. Chapter 17 starts with an interview of both sets of the parents of the two missing girls that were also taken in nearby communities. We find out that money is somehow involved. In chapter 18, Vega connects more of these dots between the two missing girls and the money, and then eventually connects it all the way back to Cole's mom. In chapter 19, Vega and Kat pay a visit to Cole's parents, the Linsomes, and she is creepily expecting them. This chapter had a lot. Press was also holding Nell captive at Cap's house, and they end up rescuing Kylie finally. Chapter 20 is a short and sweet chapter that really helped us kind of get a small peek into the lives of Jamie and Cap now and kind of wrap up a couple of loose ends while still leaving a couple hanging, keeping it interesting.
Oh my gosh. I mean, so much to talk about. I read this like immediately after we recorded our last episode and like read it in one sitting.
Same, because you texted me and told me, please read it immediately. It had been 10 minutes since I hung up the phone.
I audibly gasped when Vega like connected it. I think Luisa also did such a good job of like hiding that it like Vega knew who it was before we did. And there was like a couple of pages before we got the big reveal that it was Lindsay. But I want to know how you feel about the fact that sort of the mastermind of this whole thing was a woman and a mother. And, you know, we'll talk about this later about the mother characters that we meet in this book, but it's so often not a woman who is involved in violent crimes at all, or murders, or in this case, like sex trafficking, kidnapping, murdering, all of the terrible things. Were you expecting a twist like this, or what did you think about Lindsay being the ultimate villain?
I don't think in my wildest imaginations of what happened in this book could I have put that story together. Just, I don't think I would have connected those three dots ever until like I connected it with Vega, like as she was figuring it out, but I could have never guessed. I think it's interesting that the villain is a woman. I think that she is clearly able to emotionally kind of disconnect. And so whatever sociopathic tendencies that's showing, like she's able to do this because I do think this kind of reminds me of how they say mothers specifically when they're in these crazy situations, they're able to like lift cars or do these crazy things that are like superhuman and unimaginable in the normal day because of this like deep love for their families. I think that's a really healthy way to think of it. And I think, you know, the things that she does for children is a really unhealthy way of thinking how she is like sacrificing everything for her daughter. But I think it still plays to those same superhuman tendencies, if that makes sense. What do you think?
You know, I thought at first, like, this never happens and it would never happen. And maybe that's why it makes a great book, but also that's kind of why it's like frustrating. But then I think about like Ghislaine Maxwell, and I just finished watching The Vow and the other NXIVM documentary that's, I can't remember what the other one is called. You know, it's just my favorite to watch back-to-back documentaries about the same thing. And there were a lot of women in that case who were recruiting other women into this like cycle of sex trafficking. And it's almost scarier that Lindsay has like no regret and, you know, even has the audacity to tell Vega you would do the same thing.
Right. Well, and that's what's, I think that was what's crazy about it too. She doesn't have any regret.
We also have the parents of the two other missing girls who make an appearance. And it seems like, is it the McKennas?
Yeah. The McKennas, plastic surgery people.
It's like, it was a clue for Cap. Like, why do these people look so good? And it looks like they've like gotten work done and they've come into money and like they've lost weight and they're are dressed like they're out of an L.L. Bean catalog.
I loved that. So of funny. All catalogs to really want to look like you're out of, it's an L.L. Bean for me. Thanks.
But, you know, there's also this, like, complicity of, like, yeah, the money came in. We assumed it was something, but we didn't tell anybody about it. And also, we just spent it on ourselves. And it's, like, this complicity almost that, you know, Evan goes along with this terrible plan. Lindsay goes along with her husband being a terrible person. These parents kind of just go along with this money appearing for them.
Well, and I think some of that is like survival too. Like, I think it's easy from an outside perspective to talk about what you should or shouldn't do in a time of grief or high emotion or like complete defeat, like the McKennas were feeling. And it's easy to think of what you would do, but I think people experience that in different ways. And I think those are three very different situations, like the complicity and they got the money. They're like, our daughter is gone, and that they spent it. And maybe somebody else would have like donated it to a charity or done something else with it. But I think people grieve in different weird nose job ways.
Can we brag really fast about the things that we got right?
Yes, we have to. You want to go first?
We'll just skip over all of the things that we got wrong.
Listen back to every episode of me guessing and embarrassing myself.
You were right. I'll start with you. You were right that Cap and Vega never actually end up hooking up. We have this like awkward juggling scene at the end. I think it's maybe left open to future books that we now know that Louisa has written about Vega. But yeah, you were right.
I know, I was excited about that, that it didn't actually happen, solely for the fact that I could brag that I was right and that you weren't like predictably right about that. I loved that. And then we can talk about the one thing I was really surprised that you got right, just like, because it was chapters ago.
Really like surprised.
Well, I was just surprised you called it as something so crazy that a couple of chapters ago you mentioned that the house was so clean. The Linsome's house was so clean. It was creepy. Like, no one with kids has a house that looks like that. And something is wrong. It's too right. And I think I, at the time, was like, they're just really neat people. Let them live. But they're not. So that was good. I also think we saw a lot of kind of what we foreshadowed, or what I foreshadowed too, was that she does not introduce characters that don't come back and play a role. So even if you don't know what the role is or why you're searching Alex Chaney's apartment, like, he comes back in to play. Also, in this section, we see Vega get really emotional. I thought it was interesting that in the beginning, like, Vega's character development was interesting. In the beginning, she is this like superhuman badass who doesn't have emotions. And by the end, as she's getting closer to like being that badass and solving the case, the emotions become stronger and stronger. So I thought was an interesting parallel as we're developing the character and developing this case. What did you think about how we're getting to know Vega?
Yeah, I think we're getting a better, you know, you and I talked last week about how we were kind of shocked about how poorly she handled the shootout in the cabin. But this week, or, you know, with this week's reading and also kind of looking back at the book holistically, it's pretty obvious what Vega is actually really good at, which is like connecting the dots. So she saw that photograph and recognized it immediately as Lindsay. And she also, you know, was able to kind of pull these faces out, like, oh, Evan looks like Will Turner, and things like this. So you can kind of see now, looking back, what her strengths actually were. And her strengths were not being this like badass, untouchable spy who has no feelings. And it really, I think, also was like her emotional connection with Stacy, one of the girls' moms, that, you know, accessed this place and kind of set the stage for the ultimate betrayal coming from a mom. It was just fascinating that she kind of drove to the, she solved it all while being like hysterically crying.
We are so excited to announce the next book that we're reading. Erica, do you want to tell them what it is?
we're reading Memorial by Brian Washington. So I read Brian's short set of short stories called Lot, which I thought was just amazing. So it's those short stories were based in Houston, where Brian is from. This book is similarly based in Houston, and it is a love story between Benson and Mike, who are two young gay men who are living together in Houston. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but there's a separation. Half of the book is going to take place in Japan while the other half is in Houston. So it's sort of like a family drama, relationship drama, you know, people questioning where they come from, what they mean to each other, and what makes a great relationship.
We're so excited to read this with you all. Remember, if you're not already subscribed to our newsletter, to let us know on Instagram. You can also email us at booktalkpodcast@gmail.com and we will get you added. You can also interact with us through our website at booktalkpodcast.com or through our social media. So can't wait. Tell your friends.
Oh, yeah. Definitely tell every friend. We need this book. I feel like we need this book going into the holidays. And I just already know it's really going to like speak to us. It's going to be spiritual. I'm so excited.
It's going to be spiritual. Yeah. We need a good family home. What is the meaning of life book, you know, while we're all around the holidays and stuck inside and it gets dark at noon.
Also perfect. Japan, you know, what a concept.
Traveling. What is that? Never heard of her.
We're so excited to welcome Luisa Luna to the podcast.
As you all know, Luisa Luna is the author of Two Girls Down that we just read, and also the author of four other novels, including The Janes, which is also from the Alex Vega series. She was born and raised in San Francisco and now lives in Brooklyn with her husband and her daughter. Thank you for being here. We're so excited.
Thank you for having me. This is really a thrill. Thank you.
So we just finished this week's reading. We read like the last four chapters of Two Girls Down, where we kind of have our climactic scene and then a little bit of a come down. How were you thinking about the ending and what you wanted to tell and what you wanted to leave up to us to imagine?
Well, the last chapter that you're, you know, referring to, sort of the denouement, is, I think, important, and it was important for me to put it down and make that the end of the story, because I think it really shows how damaged the three of them are by this experience. You know, Kat, Vega, and Jamie, obviously, how the whole thing has really marked them, you know, forever. And I wanted that to be very clear. And so that was my effort in doing it. It also, in addition, I wanted, you know, sort of a last moment with Cap and Vega before they went their separate ways for now, you know. And then for Jamie, it was definitely that moment of like, she's having all these post-traumatic type of dreams. Obviously, Kylie, the older daughter, is also having all sorts of trauma. Maybe the younger daughter as well, but we don't see that in that little snippet. But, and then her younger daughter is the one who sort of brings her back to reality and like, everything is okay. We are here, but you will probably have nightmares for the rest of your life, you know? So it was just an important last chapter for me to write. And then in terms of leaving it open-ended, I did. I wanted to end this story, but absolutely leave the possibility for more.
I knew there was something off with the Linsomes, and with their house just being too nice and the way that it was described, with like a grand piano and a glass figurine and everything was white, and you're like, this is just never a good sign when parents of young children have a house that's very put together.
It's, you know, so a couple of things. One, when I was writing that scene, I did not know how the book was going to end. I didn't know who took the girls. I didn't know where they were. I mean, when you're just writing this stuff, I'm not an outliner at all. So it's funny because I think most, I can't even say this empirically, but like many mystery thriller writers, I would think, would rely on an outline because then you can map everything out. I don't.
That's crazy to me.
Made my life difficult in The Janes. And if you read it, you will see that plot almost killed me. It was so twisty and turny. However, I pulled through. But Two Girls Down, as if you do any writing, certainly if you're reading, you could probably tell this as well. But as a writer, writing that scene with Press, he was a character who, and this happens every once in a while, a supporting character who's just like, I'm not supporting. Like, I am talking for myself. And then it was just like, wow, like, who is this guy? And so most people I feel reading know something is up with him because he's such a jerk and obviously, you know, kind of a racist and like also, totally abusive. And like, you know, he's a jerk, you know, something's up, but you don't know what, and you don't know if you're never going to see him again. So when I first wrote that scene, I knew that he had something to do with it. I didn't know what. And then when it crystallized for me, I thought the more sort of far more disturbing thing, the only thing more disturbing than like a perpetrator of these sorts of crimes would be the person who enables them. So that's where the Lindsay piece came in. And she's, I mean, they're both absolutely bonkers, but like, you know, her writing her, once I figured out who she was going to be, I was like, you know, she was easier to write in that last scene when you see her and when Vega confronts her.
I want to talk about Cap and Vega because they're such interesting characters. And in that, the last couple of chapters, I feel like we really get a little bit more of an insight into Vega with her own relationship with her mother, with, you know, Lindsay looking at her and saying, if you were a mom, you would have done this too. Like, you would understand. And it's just so chilling. But, you know, we see Vega when we first meet her as kind of this like cold, detached superhero almost who can solve any crime. And then as the book evolves, you realize she's very emotional. She doesn't always get it right. Like, she gets hit in the face with a 2x4. you know, she shoots Dina when she maybe didn't need to. So she definitely has, you know, her emotions take over. But I'm wondering what you think about who Vega is in relation to this story. You know, is she the agent of chaos who really sets everything in motion? Is she kind of the like cool, unattached woman that women want to be? Or is she kind of the cool, unattached woman that, you know, Cap is waiting for to come excite his life? You know, what does she kind of like represent to you?
I would say yes. She is. Well, and I that is the thing that is sort of, you know, confusing about her, is that she can sort of do all be all of those things. I think that what makes her so good at what she does is she has a detachment from I can't say a detachment from humans, because that's also what drives her, is to sort of help people in a way, you know. But she also has a sort of cut and dried way of noticing things, you know, that aren't colored by really a notion, another preconceived notion she may have had. She's almost able, you know, to just dissect a situation for what it is and keep her emotions at bay when she needs it. And obviously towards the end of the book, that sort of is pushing, all of the limits are pushing, because certain buttons of hers are being pushed as she's talking to these various mothers and she's thinking about her mother, because she is a human, you know, so she is, you know, sort of pushed to her emotional limits in that way as well. And I found that out about her as I was going, you know, when I was writing her, I just kind of was trying to get you know, this character who would command attention, you know, as she moves through, and command respect as she moves through the story. I wanted her to be the outsider who comes in and kind of, you know, utilize that trope. But then getting to know her, her emotions, you know, come up. And sometimes, as you say, they're not always, you know, they don't always lead her in the right direction. But yeah, so I would say, yes, she is all of these things. She's all of these things. And then she's also a bit of a mercenary, you know, she's also, my husband and daughter and I were watching, you know, an episode of The Mandalorian the other night, and my daughter says, so is Boba Fett a good guy or a bad guy? And I said, good question. We don't know, really. I said, and that reminded me of Mega too. Like,
yeah,
good question, you know?
Right. I liked that it depended on the situation. Like, it was, she wasn't this perfect superhuman character who was just constantly like fighting for good. Like, she has all the qualities that make us human inside her too.
Right. Right. And she's going to mess up. Yeah. She's going to mess up. And sometimes it pays off. Sometimes it doesn't pay off. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily want to spoil us for the James, but a big conversation that we had and some of our listeners have had is kind of the will they, won't they, with Vega and Cap. And I was almost dead certain. So Katie saw this.
She was dead certain.
But I was so certain we were going to see some sort of like late night hookup. And I love that we didn't. In this case, they were both pushing themselves really to their mental and physical limit to solve this, as they knew they were getting closer and not sleeping and interrogating witnesses late. You mentioned earlier that Cap is in the Janes, so there might be more to their story coming down the road.
I liked that it was a little bit more realistic too, and we didn't have what I think people were predicting, like they fight crime and they immediately, like, the crime is solved, but really they fall in love, and that's like the kind of center stone of this. So
yeah, I wanted to stay away from I try to fight the cliches. I don't always win, but I try to fight the cliches at whatever turn I can.
I like that. I try to fight them, but I don't always.
I try them. They don't. I mean, sometimes I'll give in. I like a good cliche, but
I mean, we're all subject to it. It's fine.
Cliches are cliches for a reason. Like, right. You know, yes. Sometimes they work. Sometimes they fit. But yes, I'll always try to go the other way. I see him as really the moral compass. Like, he's the one who has a very clear idea of things that are right and wrong. And whereas Vega's moral compass is like a little floppier, I feel like Cap will, like, I mean, that's his whole backstory about losing his job is because he felt like he was doing the right thing, you know, and he felt like he was sacrificing for his friend. And, you know, so for me, he was the and sort of like the voice of reason.
So speaking of characters we loved, we adored Nell. And we got to know and see more of her character during that last stressful ending and evening. And we are wondering if you see her going down the path of her father or kind of being more involved or on the team. She's kind of an ancillary role right now, but as she grows up, and now that we know Cap and Vega keep working together, do you see any future where Nell is kind of a part of that?
Almost definitely in some way, only because she'll always have this relationship with her dad. And actually, again, not to give any spoilers for the Janes, the book takes place in California and Nell is in Pennsylvania the whole time, but she and Cap talk and text all the time. And he shares some details about the case with her and, you know, they talk it out. And so, yes, Nell is always, I'll tell you, the pieces of whenever I hit a Cap and Nell scene, it's so easy to write. And then if Cap has a moral compass, Nell is like the even like more serious moral compass. So in the Russian nesting doll of moral compasses, like Cap is like the bigger one and Nell's the one inside and just like really driving. Like when she sort of convinces him to take the case, that's her moment of just like, we are doing the right thing, you know? And part of that might be her naivete too, as being young, but who cares? You know, she'll do that, but she is a kid and she is, you know, you'll see in the Janes, she is also marked from this experience and for her own trauma, her own traumatic experience, you know, so no one gets away scot-free, you know, everyone gets affected, but she, yes, I have ideas, all kinds of ideas for spinoffs for now, like, you know.
Oh, I loved
that. She goes to college, she solves crimes in the dorm. I mean, I thought about it, all of them. I love it. I love the idea. Yes.
Yeah, we loved her. I loved reading their relationship. And now I'm nervous for Nell being home alone in Pennsylvania, but I hope that she's okay in the Janes. Okay, good. But I loved learning about their relationship. And a lot of this book was really about parenthood and I think mothering in particular. So it was really interesting to hear about Lindsay's involvement in these kidnappings and not just to hear it like on a news story, but to hear her and the way that she told Vega. And it seems like there's also a parallel in with a conversation Vega has with Stacy when she's kind of getting close to resolving it. When Stacy tells her, your mom did not get cancer from worrying about you. But I think that's exactly how Lindsay's experiencing motherhood. Like it's like a worry that is rotting her from her core. So I'm wondering if this has kind of always been a theme for you, and how Lindsay's role evolved while you're writing the book, especially if you didn't know she was going to be that one at the, when you started introducing her.
Really amazing question. You are knocking me out with these questions. The level at which you read this book, I'm just impressed. Thank you. So I wanted to keep this theme going throughout about parents and children, right? And like what parents do for children, and maybe vice versa as well, but like different kinds of relationships, what people will do, what people won't do. And the biggest difference between Vega and Lindsay, I think, comes in a piece of dialogue that I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember it exactly, but it's when Lindsay says something like, if you had children, you'd understand, it's either my kid or your kid, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when Vega says, you're a psycho. Because Vega, if Lindsay, I mean, there were people, there's this dichotomy happening everywhere with all kinds of people all the time. Well, it's either me or you, you know, and it's either my kid or your kid who's going to, you know, die or whatever. And then Vega says, doesn't have to be any of them. That's her take on it. It actually doesn't have to be anyone's kid. You're crazy, you know? So that I think is the biggest difference between the two of them. And I think that so many people make such binary choices all the time, as opposed to thinking, well, actually, we don't have to sacrifice anybody. Like, we can just do the other thing, you know? So many examples of this happen in the world and are happening. But in terms of, yes, the mother thing, definitely. And I wanted to write Stacy, that character, as sort of a woman who was really just annihilated by the disappearance of her daughter and never came back, you know, from that experience. Some people do, and they find some way to come back. And like so,
the McKennas. Is it like the McKennas?
I know, they got all pretty. Yeah. They got all handsome. They did got tanning or whatever. But you know, I wanted someone who had just sort of been gone to the other side, right, to sort of give that message back to Vega and just like, it's not your fault. Like, you had nothing to do with it. Like, that woman, Stacy, would never say like, oh, I wish I never had my kid, or I wish I never, you know, right. Wish I never had that experience of motherhood, even though she's gone.
Yeah, I liked the contrasting points of view of different kinds of motherhood and different mothers and their different reactions to kind of what had happened to them. So switching gears a little bit, I think we talked a little bit about who you are, but something I've been thinking about is if you have any background with like military or police, like detectives, anything like that, on which to draw on to create this story. So essentially, like, was the story completely made up, or was it based on any kind of like true events or past experiences?
It is totally fiction. I have no personal experience. I have a friend who is a cop, and I asked him some questions throughout. They were mostly procedural kind of questions. Mm-hmm. I also read some books, some procedure type books. There is a book called Bringing Adam Home, which is about Adam Walsh, the Adam Walsh case, which is horrifying. But it's interesting because it really breaks down how the police moved through this case in the 80s. And for me, that was just really interesting. And then I read a couple books about like bounty hunters and like fugitive recovery and stuff like that. So I just read a lot of different kinds of things to kind of get a feel for the territory. What made me feel better about it was my friend who is the cop was like, cops don't read like stories about cops. So you don't really have to worry about someone being like,
he's like, I love that.
Yeah, he was like, we must read like nonfiction. So I at some point I stopped being worried about every little detail, and I started, because I'm not going to be Richard Price who rides in the back of cop cars. Like, don't have those kinds of resources. You know what I mean? So I can't get that into the granularity of it, but I just want to make it sound realistic, you know? And if there's details off here and there, I mean, I have yet to receive an email. I got one email from one guy who's very polite, and he said I had something wrong with the guns, like something wrong with a gun and a stock. And I was like, thanks so much. Like, you're very careful. And I was like, I didn't tell him, like, I've never held a gun. I watched it on YouTube. Like, I watched this video like 20 times about, taking apart an AR-15, because Vega does that.
Yeah, that part was so interesting. That so we talked a lot like, about that scene.
I watched
scene.
It like 30 times. Like, I just watched it so I could describe it and make it sound realistic.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So yes, I do not have any specific, I did that kind of research. If I were going to say, write a book like about the medical profession or something like that, mm-hmm. I would have to do a whole other level, you know?
Right.
But I feel like this is more ultimately character-based and mm-hmm. plot-based, and doesn't rely too much on the bones of procedure. So I have to make it seem realistic, but not so much so that it's kind of paralyzing.
I think you did a great job. Obviously, we were wondering if you had any experience. So clearly, completely correct.
I like too that, like, I mean, you can tell it's a little bit outside of what the police and the detectives are doing, but I think it's so, like, the amazing part about the story is they're kind of getting there in parallel. Like, the police had this connection. Like, there's something about the ballet studio, and the way that, you know, a detective would approach it is like, we need to go interview everybody who has gone to that studio, anybody who looked weird, look at the delivery drivers, like everybody who's coming in and out of the studio. And, you know, Vega's kind of running around trashing people's houses and, you know, destroying a bar to get to the same answer.
Yes.
But they end up kind of in the same place. But yeah, we have no idea if the police would have gotten there in time, or how long that would have taken if they also weren't pushing each other to come to the solution. One thing I wanted to ask about is there's some hints throughout the book of like a little bit of supernatural elements, at least, that Vega experiences. Like, she sees the girls when she's in a handstand. You know, she feels like something's about to happen with the photograph. And then the kind of, you know, there's this, the photographs spill out over the car, and that's when she sees Lindsay at the piano. Do you think that the universe or spirit or God, or is there something that's guiding Vega, or is this kind of her intuition that is giving her these kind of clues that she's getting close to the answer?
Well, I think that intuition or gut feeling or hunches or ESP or psychic power are just the same things by different names. And so, I don't think she is receiving, you know, messages from another plane per se, but I do think that she just has a certain, yes, she has an intuition. I think that one of her talents, and I feel like I get into this in the Janes a little bit more, and the, as well as the third one I just wrote, is that she can just sort of instantly narrow down the options. And she just does it very quickly. So I didn't think about anything external per se, anything supernatural, but you know, who am I to say? Who knows? Maybe. Yeah. And if you read that, you know, the reader's the boss. So you know, if you read it and it's, you know, it could be, I don't know. I you know, have a lot of like visual, you know, there's a lot of visual imagery happening for me when I'm writing. So to picture the two girls standing there in their party dresses was like too creepy not to put down, you know, like as she's doing the hands down, like it's just spooky.
I think we did also agree that like Vega's, her quote unquote supernatural power is definitely her ability to kind of connect those dots and do it in a way that people without that level of intuition can't do or can't do as quickly. So I think that's interesting. We have a couple more quick questions that our readers and us had. So we're almost, I know we're over time, but are you still okay? Okay. So these are a little bit more general. So I'm really interested in why or how you chose to write thrillers or mystery books, and like what this genre like means to you. I think it's so interesting that you can kind of create these tangled webs and stories. So just a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So it's a genre I've always enjoyed. It's not the only, I mean, if I talk about my favorite writers, there's only a couple of really thriller mystery writers that make that cut. I like thrillers and mysteries and series that have the characters continually turning and doing different things. I don't like the carbon copy of like the same detective going in, you know, doing the same stuff every time. Some people love that. Like that's why they buy a million of one kinds of series, because they just love to see their favorite character in these situations time and again. I like them to be challenged and you know, dynamic. And so, but the actual writing of thrillers and mysteries, I mean, when I started writing Two Girls Down, I was like, I've read a lot of these and I'm going to give it a try. I obviously had some experience writing fiction.
Were your other ones mystery thrillers?
The last one I wrote was sort of a noir. So, but it was not very disciplined at all, you know? So it was kind of a mystery, but it was really more of like a character piece. And there was a mystery in there, like a thread of a mystery in there, but it wasn't very, robust in its way. So I had like a little bit of a map, and then I was just like, I'm gonna try this. And then I really had kind of just a fake it till you make it attitude with Two Girls Down. I was just like, I'm just gonna keep going and see what happens. And you know, I was working, for me, when writing, it comes with some images first. And so I had this image of a woman standing on her hands, and she was gonna be my sort of hero or my protagonist. And then I had the image of her dragging some guy across the parking lot. And I was like, how am I going to
throwing hot tea?
I said, how am I going to connect these two? So then that was sort of the building blocks. I can't even say it was a decision to write thrillers. I just had the idea of writing this character and having two missing girls and seeing what happened in a small town, you know, and seeing what happened.
So I think that was like kind of my follow-up question, but I think you answered it. Just like, was there something about this specific story or how it ended that you wanted to tell, but was it all just like how it developed and how it came out rather than
like, yeah, I mean, I didn't start off with a huge agenda. As I got into it, I really thought it was about that theme of parents and kids, and yeah. Over and over and over again, you know, and, you know, I started writing it when my daughter was two. And so having a kid, you know, for the first time, I was just like, oh, my gosh, like the world is full of such danger, you know? Yeah. And I you feel like a whole level of fear, you know, that you've never felt before. So that's also where it came from.
I was wondering if being a mom had yourself had impacted that.
Yes. Yeah, so I have friends, you know, like my daughter's friends, parents who are like, I can't read your book. I was like, it's okay. You don't have to, because they have kids, you know? And I mean, a lot of people. And then a woman actually wrote to me like last week or the week before. She was like, I love your book, The Janes. I haven't finished it because it was stressing me out too much. And I was like, please finish it. You'll be rewarded. Trust me. And then she wrote back and she was like, I finished it. Thank you for telling me. It was really cute. I was like, you've got to try. It just do
You're
it.
This far in. Don't end when it's bad. Yeah.
She was like, it's just stressing me out. So, you know.
I truly can't imagine being stressed and not finishing a book like this. Like, she was, I had to finish
it. She was
it.
Like, she wanted to write to me and tell me she loved it. And she's like, didn't finish it. I love it. Then she did. So it came full circle for her.
All right. Well, last question. What are you currently reading right now? And what are you drinking to get yourself through COVID?
Okay. You're gonna like both of these answers. So I am reading, believe it or not, I'm reading The Hunger Games. Because, well, I've never read it, but I want to read it to see if it's appropriate for my daughter to read, because she's 10. She loves series books. And even though Hunger Games is technically YA, I'm just seeing if it's like too violent and it'll give her nightmares or anything. But frankly, like, she watches the news with us. So anything that's happening,
that'll give you nightmares.
Anything that happened in Panem is really, the real world's far more bleak right now. So it's like, she may be fine with it. She may be fine with it. And then the most important drink to me daily is coffee. I drink 1-2 strong cups of coffee. I don't understand the people who just drink like a pot of like medium coffee. You know what I mean?
No.
I mean, I love you as humans, but I don't understand you.
What's your favorite type of coffee, or like your go-to coffee?
Oh, so there's a place in my neighborhood where I buy like the grounds and then I make it here like in a little one-hitter filter. And so it's very strong, but not bitter. That's the thing.
That's the key. Ooh,
very strong, but not bitter. I don't like bitter coffee. And if you have like light coffee or like, you know, so I like to think I'm not picky, but I think I am. I mean, whatever. If I don't have any options, I'll drink whatever you've got. Yeah. You know what I mean? But if I have options, I'm like, let's make it very strong.
Given the choice.
And I'll notice myself going to bed at night and I'll be like, oh, I guess it's time to go to bed. I was like, I can wake up and have coffee. You know, I'm excited to kind
sometimes
of
sometimes I think about that. I'm like, there's a latte waiting on the other end of this.
I know. I think that's just addiction. That's just what that is. It's just, but you know what? I'm good with it. Even, I mean, I would only stop if like a doctor was like, you are literally gonna die if you drink coffee. And even then I would be like, is it gonna be like a quick death or painful? Because I don't know, you know. I think I might be able to be okay with that. We'll see. Yeah, I don't think anyone's. I don't drink that much, but enough to get me through.
Plus one PS question. What's your favorite bookstore in Brooklyn?
Oh, it's got to be Community. Community bookstore on 7th Ave, which I don't think people are going in yet, but you can order and pick up at the door. So I've been doing that a lot. And they must think, I mean, they must know I have a kid at home because I've been picking up all of these like middle school age books, and I'm picking up The Hunger Games and The Golden Compass, and they're like, so I'm sure they see me and they're like, she's got a thing going on with these kinds of like fantasy dystopian books.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This was so fun.
Yes, I had a wonderful time. Please read The Janes. I'll come back.
We have to now. I have to know. I have to know what happens with Cap and Vega.
You really do.
Yeah.
I really can't tell you. I can't tell you, but yes, absolutely. Thank you both for having me.
Talk, talk.
Talk, talk. Okay, so let's for talk, since we did it with Louisa, what are you currently reading and drinking?
Okay, so I just picked up this book called Severance by Ling Ma from the library. And this is like an apocalyptic book. And the tagline is it the end of the world or just another day at the office? And I'm like, wow, am I living this book or am I living it? I can't wait. I can't remember where someone definitely recommended this book to me and I can't remember who it was. I'm so sorry, but I'm very excited to read this. And then in terms of drinking, you will never guess.
Hot tea?
I'm drinking hot tea.
No! Wait, I was totally kidding and you're actually drinking hot tea.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. Okay, so I did sober October and I genuinely like don't really have a taste for booze anymore. I don't know what is going on. I was like drinking a bottle of wine a night pre-October.
I love that for you. Yikes.
And now I don't know. But so I have this tea that my good friend, best friend, one of my best friends, Elise, gets at this special Indian grocery store on the Lower East Side. And she's like, this is chai. Like, this is like good tea. She's Pakistani. And I became addicted to it while we were upstate. And now this is what I drink all day, every day, is this chai. What about you?
I am currently drinking crappy red wine because I still can't taste. But also I haven't drank for like 2 weeks. So I felt like tonight my nerves needed it. Because I've recovered from COVID and also interviewed an author. So I just like crappy red wine for me. I started reading The Very Last Story of Mina Lee. And so it's a story about a first-generation Korean-American. Her mom is an immigrant, and she discovers her mom's death. Like, she finds her. It's, like, a pretty traumatic beginning. And the book is really, like, her struggling to understand the meaning of family and home in kind of the context of that. So, in the context of being, like, a first-generation in America. So, I'm excited to read that.
Talk is made by me, Erica Bailey, and Katie Cheney, with production support from Dan White. Our theme music is by Dan White. We'll see you next week.